The April 3rd, 2015 rain report is just seconds away at 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Arkansas studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, with this rain report. How many hams do you know in your area who are blind? More than you think. One blind ham who is a tenured professor in marketing at Western Kentucky University is Dr. Ron Milliman, K8HSY. Ron was recently interviewed on the Ham Radio Weekly podcast QSO Today by its founder, Eric 4U1UG. This is one of two excerpts we'll be bringing you over the next 2 weeks from that hour-long interview.
I got in about the same age as a lot of people. Having listened to your other podcasts, it's amazing how many of us have got in about the same time. I was about 10 years old. I used to like to go to my grandmother's house because she had one of these large floor model Zenith radios. It was like a piece of furniture. It had a big round dial in the front, AM and shortwave. And I would sit in front of that for hours, sit on the floor and just tune in the various shortwave stations, the foreign broadcast stations. And hams. At first, I didn't know what they were, and it was really fascinated with the conversations. That was back in the AM days. I used to listen to them on 80 meters, and at the time, I didn't know I was listening to 80 meters, but I was listening to 80 meter phone. Then I asked, what in the world is that? And I discovered that it was called ham radio or amateur radio. Probably like you, one of the first things I would do, because I love books and love the library, I immediately went to the library, started reading everything I could find dealing with ham radio and amateur radio. I learned about the ARRL. Then I got, I guess they called it a trilogy. I'm not really sure what they called it. It was a set of books that you could get, introductory books. It was How to Become a Radio Amateur, the Operating Manual. Can't remember the exact name of that anymore. And the License Manual. And so I started studying for my novice test. My parents were always very supportive. And they got me a 10-in-1 kit. I think that might have even been a night kit. But it was from Allied Radio. That's how I learned the basics of home brewing and building things. And I remember building a little broadcast transmitter with that where I could broadcast a signal around the house and pretend like I was operating my own commercial station and that sort of thing. My dad and I were never very close. And I mention that because ham radio helped, I think, bring my dad and I closer together because his helped me build the kits and helped me put up antennas and that sort of thing, gave us something in common. And later on, when my son got involved in ham radio, I think that helped make my son and I really quite close. In fact, ham radio, that's most of what we do when we're together anymore is ham radio stuff. Mm-hmm. I was about 10, 11 years old. My parents got me for Christmas, and this will bring back memories for you too, I imagine, an Ocean Hopper kit. Again, that was a night kit. This Ocean Hopper really didn't even have a case. It was a front, kind of front panel and a chassis. My dad and I put it together as a project. We got all done with it and all, you know, we're all excited. Ah, this is, it's finally ready to plug in and test. And we plugged it in and it was totally dead. I mean, like nothing. You can imagine how disappointed we were. We went back over all the wiring and could not find anything wrong. Everything seemed to be exactly the way it should be. We took it over to a fellow that we got to know fairly well because back in those days, there were TV repairmen that would come to your home and fix your TVs and that sort of thing. And this guy that we took it to, his name was Bob Besser. He became one of my Elmers, by the way. Bob Besser put this little Ocean Hopper up on his test bench, and I don't think it took him 5 minutes to see what the problem was. There was a little insulating washer that went underneath the antenna clip that insulated it from the chassis that was missing. And so the antenna was basically shorted to the chassis. As soon as we put that insulating washer on there and connect up to an antenna, bingo, we had signals coming in. And I listened to that with headphones on. I listened to that all night long. We used to tune in 80 meters and 40 meters. It had plug-in coils. And so I had to change coils as I changed bands. It didn't have a band switch on it. It had just plug-in coils. It was a super regenerative receiver. Uh-huh. So it was fairly sensitive, but it was a long ways from being very selective.
You know, as parents, we're worried about our teenage children being up all night on the internet and not getting enough sleep. But we would never tell our children that as hams or prospective hams that we used to stay up all night listening to 80 meters on the general coverage receiver next to the bed.
Yeah, and boy, those AM signals, they sounded so good. Oh, I loved to listen to some of those old AM signals, the DX100s and the D104 mics, the Globe Kings, you know, they sounded great. I was having problems in school a little bit. I developed a very rare illness when I was 8 years old. It's called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. I was in the hospital for several weeks, and when I got out, it looked like I'd been in a very severe fire, and I had scars basically from head to toe from that illness. It left me partially sighted. I was pretty much totally blind in one eye and partially sighted in the other. Before that, I had perfect sight. I didn't have no vision problems at all, but after that illness, I was partially sighted. I mentioned that only because I struggled, especially in the sixth grade in public school, being able to see the chalkboard, and my teacher was not quite as helpful as she probably could have been. My parents thought that it would be in my best interest to have me go to a different kind of school. So starting in the seventh grade, I started attending the Michigan School for the Blind, which, by the way, I did not want to do at all. I grew up with the same group of kids, and all my friends were in my hometown, Sturgis, Michigan. I absolutely did not want to go. I didn't even think of myself as being blind or even sight impaired. I just thought I was like everybody else. And so the idea of going to a school for the blind, I just could not deal with that very well.
That was a school where you also lived on campus?
Exactly. Or? Yeah, it was a boarding school.
You were quite young and moving away from home.
Yeah, I was 12 years old. When I got to the school, I discovered that there were other kids up there that were also interested in ham radio. We got to be all really very good friends. The main thing we had in common was ham radio. And one of the students that was going to the school, his father was also interested in ham radio and was studying to get his novice license. And his name was George Wood. We called him Woody. Woody kind of took the leadership role in forming a study group. And there was several of us from the school was in this study group. And we would go over to Woody's house and study the license manual to get ready for our novice test and study the code. We had code practice that we did as well. So as a result, we all got our licenses at about the same time. I got my novice license in March of 1957. I was 13 years old. You probably remember when you got your first license. That was an exciting experience, taking the test, and you had to wait to find out whether you passed and finally get your license. And wow, that was an exciting day.
What was your call sign?
It was KN8HSY. It's kind of interesting because now my call is K8HSY. I wasn't a novice too long. And I went on to get my general, which is an interesting experience because back in those days, you had to actually draw out the schematic diagrams. And it wasn't like the tests are today. As you well remember, you had to go actually to the FCC office. And the engineer in charge, as they called them back in those days, administered the license exam. I got my general, and then I became K8HSY. Now, since then, I've actually had several calls. As you recall, a few years ago, when you moved from one call district to another, you had to file a new Form 610, right, and your call changed, and you didn't have any choice. So when I moved from Michigan to Arizona to go to graduate school later, I became W7GPF. When I moved to Texas, I got a 5 call and so forth. So I've had actually several calls. I've been in Kentucky here for several years, and I just decided that I was going to go back and become K8HSY again. It was available, so that's what I did.
You're listening to an excerpt from the QSO Today Ham Radio podcast that recently featured Dr. Ron Milliman, K8HSY, a tenured professor of marketing who has taught at Western Kentucky University since 1985. We'll continue Eric 4U1UG's conversation with this blind entrepreneur after I remind you that the Rain Report is accessible on demand from therainreport.com and via Twitter at hashtag The Rain Report. You're listening to an excerpt from the QSO Today Ham Radio podcast that recently featured Dr. Ron Milliman, K8HSY, a tenured professor of marketing who has taught at Western Kentucky University since 1985. We'll continue Eric 4U1UG's conversation with this blind entrepreneur after I remind you that the Rain Report is accessible on demand from therainreport.com and via Twitter at hashtag The Rain Report.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
What was your first rig?
That's interesting because, again, in reference to Elmers, another Elmer that I had was Leo Bryant, W8AJM. And Leo was actually a friend of my dad's. They'd gone to school together. My dad knew him. And so when I got interested in ham radio, my dad took me over to meet Leo. And Leo kind of took me under his wing and helped me out. And I mentioned that in response to my first rig because he loaned me a homebrew rig to start out with. It was a homebrew transmitter, crystal control, but he also had a VCO, voltage controlled oscillator. There was a switch on the front where you could switch it from crystal to VCO. And since I was novice, I couldn't use the VCO. And he warned me, he said, now this is a switch. You flip that switch, you get into the VCO. And he said, you're not allowed to have that. So you just leave that switch alone, which I actually did. I left it alone. But I mentioned that because he also gave me a couple schematic diagrams. And he said, if you're going to be a real ham, you're going to have to learn how to build stuff. You're going to have to really know electronics because, and that's Leo. He really knew his electronics. And he said, so if you're going to be real ham and you want me to work with you, he said, you're going to have to learn this stuff. He gave me a couple schematics of a little two-tube rig. It's a 5U4 rectifier and a 6L6 oscillator. Basically, it was a crystal-controlled oscillator. But he gave me two schematics to that rig. He said, now, you pick the one you want, but I want you to build that. He said, I can help you. Call me on the phone. Need some help, but I want you to build a transmitter. And so it was about, what, a 15, 20-watt transmitter. And it had plug-in coils. You plugged them into like a tube socket. And so if I wanted to change from 80 to 40, I had to plug in another coil. One diagram he gave me had the B-plus power going to the plate of the 6L6 going through the link tank circuit to the plate. The other schematic had the B-plus going through a RF choke to the plate. Was at the bottom side of the RF choke on the power supply side had a bypass capacitor to ground to keep any RF getting back to the power supply. And he just left me with them. Well, I looked at them, and for some reason, I don't know why, I picked the one with the B-plus going through the tank circuit. And the funny part of that is I learned later that that was not the best one to choose, especially when you had that tank circuit exposed as a plug-in coil. Later, when I told Leo about it, he laughed, and he said, well, I wonder how long it's going to take you to learn which one of those circuits you should have built. And so, needless to say, I changed the circuitry and I went to the other. It was a very simple change to make.
What role did amateur radio play in your teenage years?
You know, we practically lived and breathed ham radio. It was our life. The three things in our life was ham radio, girls, and school, not necessarily in that order. I was also involved in sports. I was in wrestling in school and track and other athletic events. So there were other things that occupied my time, but ham radio was a substantial part of it. We lived in a dormitory. All of us that got our licenses, we didn't have a central station to use there at the school. And so I had my rig in my room. Some of the other guys had rigs in their room. We had probably three different rigs in the dorm there that we operated. It was definitely a major part of our life, and it was quite a challenge to string up antennas. We experimented with everything from loading up bed springs to window screens to dangling wire out the windows. I mean, everything you can imagine. And back in those days, with the Pi networks, you could load anything. I had a DX40 that I got later on, and I learned the hard way that high SWR can also burn up a radio. I ended up with an S38. That was certainly a step up from the Ocean Hopper, but the Hellcrafter's S38, and it wasn't that good either. It was okay, but it wasn't very good. So then I got an ARC 5, military surplus command set ARC 5, one for 80 meters and one for 40. They were pretty good. But then Christmas of 1958, I believe, I had been 59, my parents got me a Hellcrafter's SX71. And I thought I was in heaven when I opened up that box and saw that SX71, and I was so excited. I'll never forget that. I used that SX71 for several years. That was a pretty hot receiver.
What impact did amateur radio have on your choice of schooling after high school and what you did in your career?
Not a great deal. I thought I wanted to go into electrical engineering. The dean of the school that I was attending thought that while I was probably intelligent enough, I was pretty much a straight A student. He thought that electrical engineering was probably going to be pretty challenging. But rather than telling me I couldn't do it, which was entirely the wrong thing, could you tell me I couldn't do something, why that was one thing I was absolutely going to do. Instead, he knew the head of the department at Michigan State, the head of the electrical engineering department, and he arranged a luncheon between me and the department head at Michigan State. And the department head and I had an interesting discussion, being very skillful and very tactful in the way they presented it, primarily the department, convinced me that there'd be so many challenges. Back in those days, there was almost nothing that was accessible. In fact, the meters were all visual. Everything was oscilloscopes. Everything was totally visual. And I wanted to go to Michigan State. He thought that the challenges would be pretty much insurmountable. And so as a result of that, I changed my mind. I ended up going on to a college majoring. In fact, I ended up as a triple major, majoring in sociology, psychology, and business. I was always interested in business. When I was a little kid, I was going door-to-door selling things, and I've always been involved in business. In high school, I was very much involved in business. That luncheon really changed my destiny. You know, in life, when you look back over life, there's certain junction points in your life. And if you take path A versus path B, it completely changes your whole life. And I imagine that was one of those paths that totally changed my life. It's hard to tell what would have happened if I would have gone into engineering. But I don't regret doing what I've done. I went on into business when I graduated from an undergraduate school, was in the insurance and real estate business for a while. I decided that that's not what I wanted to do the rest of my life. And I went on to graduate school for my MBA and PhD at Arizona State University. My PhD is in business economics and quantitative system statistics. But I was a ham all that time. I mean, I've never stopped being a ham until late in my career. And then I decided that I had to really devote so much more time to my career than what I was. I needed to let ham radio go for a while. I went on a hiatus for about 10 or 11 years.
That's our first excerpt from a recent conversation heard on QSO Today with Dr. Ron Milliman, K8HSY, Western Kentucky University, tenured professor of marketing who happens to be blind. We'll bring you one more excerpt from Eric 4U1UG's conversation with Ron next time. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2015 Rain. All rights reserved. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.